McCain is planning a campaign rally in South Carolina today before heading home to Atlanta to meet face-to-face with his wife for the first time since a woman claimed to have had a long extramarital affair with Kane. Kane is denying that affair, but he acknowledges having a friendship with Ginger White, and he acknowledges giving her some money.
My wife did not know about it, and that was the revelation and the surprise that my wife found out about it when she went public with it. My wife now knows. My wife and I have talked about it, and I have explained it to her. Mm-hmm. And, my wife understands.
Kane interviewed on C-SPAN. He's reassessing his White House bid and expects to make a decision before Monday. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from DreamWorks Pictures and Touchstone Home Entertainment with The Help, starring Viola Davis, on Blu-ray December 6th, rated PG-13.
WILL-AM is going off the air temporarily for routine maintenance. Our AM programming continues on WILL-FM 90.9 HD3 and online at will.illinois.edu. This is WILL Urbana.
When you donate appreciated stock you've held for more than a year instead of selling it, you can save tax two ways. First, you avoid capital gains tax on the increase in value of your stock. Second, you receive a deduction for the full fair market value of the stock on the date you make the gift. I'm Donda Beard, and you can call me at WILL for more information about giving stock. Thanks for your support.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both programs are coming to you from the Focus Archives. They are shows that we first broadcast in August. Many of the past programs are there for you to listen to anytime you like. You can also check up on the schedule. That's WILL.illinois.edu. But just for this morning, in these 2 hours of Focus, we'll not be taking calls. Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over time, humans have developed a unique connection with other animals, and certainly true that no other mammals raise and support the young of other species as we do. Our guest for the program, Penn State anthropologist Pat Shipman, says that this bond with animals has been an enduring trend in human evolution, one that predates the development of agriculture. This morning, Pat Shipman will share her thoughts on the contribution of animals to human evolution. That is something that she writes about in her book, The Animal Connection. The subtitle is A New Perspective on What Makes Us Human. It's published by W.W. Norton and has just recently come out. Our guest, Pat Shipman, is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at Penn State. She's authored a number of other books, including Femme Fatale, which is a biography of Mata Hari, the spy, also Ape in the Tree, To the Heart of the Nile, and The Man Who Found the Missing Link. She contributes to publications including American Scientist, New Scientist, The Independent, and The Guardian, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And Professor Shipman, hello.
Hello. Nice to talk with you this morning.
Well, it's great to talk with you as well. You begin with a question that I think has occupied people for a long time. At least it has been asked, and people have attempted to answer it. And that is the question, what does it mean to be human? Really, the question is, what makes us different? What makes human beings, the human animal, different from other animals? And it seems that at the moment, we can claim just a handful of things, but they are big things. And those are making tools and using language and domestication of animals. But you take it really further than that, arguing that there's a fourth very important thing that maybe makes us special, and that is this connection that we have with animals.
Yes, it's something that is universal. That is, you can go any place in the world, any group of people, any ethnicity, any socioeconomic status, any education level, and you will find people voluntarily living with other animals, taking them in, feeding them, nurturing them, caring for them, expending energy on them. And it suddenly struck me that this is a truly bizarre characteristic, and one that no other animal does. in the wild. Now, before everybody calls in and says, but I've seen these photographs on the internet, or I've seen transplanted embryos in zoos being raised by another species, that is always with human intervention. It simply is not something animals do in the wild, and they don't do it for a very good reason. If I take in an animal domesticated or undomesticated, since I have a choice now, being modern, and I give it food, and I nurture it, and I care for it, and I expend energy keeping it warm, keeping it safe, or keeping it cool, which comes to mind in the summer, those are all resources that I don't offer to my own family, to my own kin. Now, the fundamental rule in evolution is that all that really matters is getting your genes into the next generation, so you ought to take good care of those related to you and not care at all about those who are not related to you. Well, that means if I take in a baby squirrel and look after it, or a wolf or a kitten, I'm doing something that actually potentially harms my own kin, and it doesn't make sense. This realization made me start looking for what the history was of our connection to animals and what the evolutionary payoff was for being connected to animals. And I discovered a sort of theme in human evolution that most people had missed completely, that certainly even those who were aware of it had perhaps underrated in importance, and something that I think was profoundly important in making humans humans.
Well, this is, I think that's really, it's a fascinating argument, and it's something that also takes us back in human history to a point significantly before domestication of animals. I suppose some people would think, well, okay, what we're really talking about here is the point where people started to raise sheep and goats and cattle and things like that, and it's somehow tied with people settling down and tied with agriculture. And you have a completely different way of looking at it. We'll push that aside for a moment, but this really does indeed go back millions of years, way back before animals become domesticated. And you really make the argument that it connects with these other things. And why don't we let's start with the oldest invention, stone tools.
Right. Stone tools changed the life of our ancestors, our lineage, profoundly. What we were before the invention of stone tools was something, the best analog we have is maybe a chimp or a bonobo or a large baboon. That is, we were fundamentally a prey animal. We lived on fruit and other vegetable matter. We were highly social. We were pretty smart as animals go, but we were definitely on the receiving end, shall we say, of predation. And so our big issue was, how can I not get eaten and yet get enough to eat every day myself? When the first incredibly clever individual realized that you could take a kind of shapeless lump, a heavy piece of rock, and manipulate it in the right way, strike it in the right way, handle it in the right way, and you could come out with something like a razor blade. You could come out with something incredibly sharp that enabled you to get access to all kinds of food that you hadn't done before. And what we have in the fossil record is, as soon as stone tools appear, which is based on current evidence, 2.6 million years ago, from that point, immediately, we begin finding lots and lots of animal bones with cut marks from stone tools. We find animal bones broken open using tools. We find cut marks on them that say meat was being removed, hide was being removed, tendon was being removed, fat was being removed. They're broken open from marrow, which is an incredibly good nutritional resource. We had no way of getting to those before. They were non-existent if all you had was your hands and your teeth and you were the kind of animal we were. But all of a sudden, with stone tools, we became a paradoxical animal. We became one that had none of the equipment of a carnivore or a predator. That is, we weren't terribly large. We weren't terribly fast. We didn't have big claws. We didn't have sharp teeth. We didn't have an acute sense of smell and all of those attributes that make carnivores good predators. So we didn't have those, but we had this little piece of rock. And that let us get at some of what the predators fed on all the time. And it happened immediately. So all of a sudden, we were a predator with the equipment of a prey animal.
Yeah. I like that you have one of the chapters where you discuss this, you have titled Evolve Without Evolving, which I like that because I think it puts it very nicely that here, by learning how to do this and making this craft, it made it possible for human beings to become hunters and compete with predators that were much more suited to the task because they had these natural attributes. Well, we didn't need to have them. We made them for ourselves.
Yes, and it's kind of a shortcut, if you want to think of it that way. We didn't have to spend millions of years becoming a tiger. We became a sort of a tiger almost instantly. And in fact, when you look at the animals that our early ancestors were able to access with these stone tools, you find that we operated like a super predator. We operated like something like a lion that hunts in groups and is very large and very powerful and very ferocious, because we could take animals much bigger than ourselves, or at least we could get at their meat. Maybe we scavenged them. I've written a lot about that issue too, and I think it's quite possible. But it put us in competition with these long-evolved predators, and that's a dangerous thing. That's a bad place to be. It's very worrisome. And the way that our kind seems to have coped with it is by becoming extremely alert to what other animals were doing. Not only did we want to watch the prey animals that we might be able to capture and eat, but we wanted to look over our shoulder and see who was planning on capturing and eating us or coming in and taking our prey away from us. Very, very few animals have been in this strange situation. And what it did was it placed a premium on information. We needed to know all about those other animals. We needed to know what they did, how they moved, whether a lion sitting in this posture was about to jump and rip our throat out, or whether a lion in that posture was digesting the antelope it had just eaten and really wasn't interested in anything except a nap.
Hmm. See, this is a really interesting argument, and maybe people wouldn't automatically make the connection between stone tools and hunting, and then other things that come from being able to have that animal protein in your diet. But also, interestingly enough, you'd say, well, you're all saying, well, but look at the position now that human beings were in, as being both predator and prey. So what they had to do was to learn, in a sense, to learn how to think like both, and and to watch them very carefully and think about how they live, where they go, where do you find them, how do they respond to threat, how do you go about hunting, how do you go about trying to get away from somebody who's hunting you, and all of that would have to be the result of some pretty careful observation of both these big categories, the ones who are doing the hunting and the ones that are being hunted.
Yes, and I think that is where our evolutionary history began to take on a very distinctive characteristic. We were no longer, strictly speaking, prey. We were not, strictly speaking, predators. We were doing something of both. And a term has been invented for this, which is informivore. That is, we were consumers of information, and the information was about other animals. It became terribly essential to be able to read what was going on with other animals, to remember where you saw them, what habitat you saw them in, what they did, whether or not they were living in groups, whether, you know, if you saw one of them, did that mean there were more? Or did it mean, no, there's one, you know where it is, no problem. So it put a premium on our mental capacity to connect to these other species. And I think you'd have to look a long, hard time before you would find another animal whose survival was so dependent upon gathering and collecting information about other species. This is a big data information problem.
Let me, for the benefit of anyone who might have just tuned in, let me introduce again the guest for this hour of focus, Pat Shipman. She is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at Penn State, and she is the author of a new book that we're talking about. The title of the book is The Animal Connection, A New Perspective on What Makes Us Humans, published by W.W. Norton, in which he makes the argument that the very special kind of connection that humans have with other animals, with non-human animals, is not only is it very important, it was something that was a real factor in human evolution and tied very closely to development of other essential things like tools and language and domestication of animals. Just for a moment, if we could take a stroll down a side street here for
sure.
Just a second, because you do spend a lot of time in the book talking about tools and tool making. And I expect people will think back to nature documentaries they've seen or time that they've spent in a classroom where they have seen what seem to be, first of all, examples of animals using tools, but also at least maybe a few, maybe not a lot, but a few cases that would seem to show an animal making one.
Yes,
sure. So the question is, well, what constitutes tool using is one thing, but what tool making, now that's something that's actually a little bit more special and refined. So what constitutes tool making?
I would say having to intentionally modify whatever the natural object is you start with. And in this regard, our ancestors went much farther than any living animal we are familiar with who makes tools. We've all seen, or many of us have certainly seen, nature documentaries about chimpanzees termite fishing. Mm-hmm. And they'll take a twig and they'll get one the right length and the right flexibility, and they'll carefully trim off all the leaves, and then they'll poke it into the termite nest and pull it out with termites on it and gobble them up like blueberries. Yes, that's certainly modifying the original twig, but it is also taking advantage of the natural structure of the twig. That is, a twig is an elongate object. It's a long, thin thing. And so you start with a long, thin thing, and you take off protrusions that would make it not useful for your task. There are, for example, wonderful data about chimpanzees in Fongoli in Central Africa that Jill Pruitz in Iowa has collected, and her chimpanzees make essentially spears out of thin pieces of wood, poke them into holes to extract bush babies or squirrels or other animals that might be living in the holes, and they seem to do it extremely deliberately. They do shape them, they do sharpen them. It's a very intentional process, but again, the object they start with already has that shape. What happens with stone tools is quite different. If you go out on the beach or in your back garden, you're going to find rocks of all kinds of shapes. And some of them maybe are a little bit sharp, although I have to say, when I want a sharp rock, I can't find one. You can never find a sharp rock
when you need it.
One.
Yeah, exactly.
But what people start with are stones that generally are called cobbles. They're kind of big, rounded or oval, kind of oval things. They're heavy. And when you make a stone tool out of it, you make something that has quite different properties. It's much smaller. It's not rounded. It's sharp. It's much lighter. You know, the extreme is a single flake, which I referred to as a razor blade earlier. That's nothing like the thing you start with. So it's a real transformation of the original object. The other difference, which is very interesting, is when we look at other animals that use and make tools, and there are a number of them, and it's remarkable and interesting in its own right, as well as for the insight it offers us about ourselves. Generally speaking, they don't use it to get animal protein. Now, I talked about the chimps and fungoli that clearly do. But they don't cut up the animal when they get it. In fact, chimps, baboons, almost any primate you want to talk about that does eat live prey or recently live prey, they simply rip them apart with their teeth and hands. They aren't taking down something bigger than themselves, and they aren't cutting it up. It's small enough that they can grab it, you know, put a piece in their mouth and pull. So that's a very different kind of access to protein. And in fact, the latest data I've looked at for chimpanzees says that animal protein, though it is intellectually important and extremely interesting, constitutes a few percent of their total intake. It's not a big deal. It's certainly not meat dependence. It's certainly not the predominance of predation in their diet or in their food collecting activities. So it's there are some differences that I think account for the special nature of stone tools and what they have done in terms of our evolution. Another question some of your listeners might have is, now wait a minute, I've seen some stuff about an experiment where people took bonobos and taught them to make stone tools. And this is absolutely true, and I have visited Kenzie, the most famous bonobo who does this, and Pan Benicia, his half-sister. And they make stone tools. Unquestionably, they do. And they know how, and they know what they're doing, and they know it's going to give them access to food. One of the things that interested me about watching them and talking with their carers and with the archaeologists who taught them to make stone tools is they were taught to make them with a setup where there's a box, a wooden box. The bonobo sees somebody put food inside that box, close it, and tie it shut with a rope. They can't get through the rope with their fingers, nails, or teeth. It's too thick. Once they learned to make a sharp rock by hitting one rock with another, they very quickly would test the sharpness of the pieces that they created, go over, learn to saw at the rope, get it open, get the food. They don't run around trying to see what in the natural world they can cut. And I was very interested to see this. Think of a three-year-old who gets a pair of sharp scissors or a knife, and you know, mother is running after the child immediately because the child's trying it on everything. Hmm. You know, sister, the furniture, the tree, the bush, anything, you know, what can I cut? I have a sharp thing, what can I cut? Bonobos don't seem to do this. Cutting is to cut that rope to get in the box to get the treat that's in there. It's not, in some way, it doesn't open a world of opportunity to them that they are interested in. Hmm. So they're physically capable of doing it. The stories of them learning to do it are quite hilarious because bonobos have very big hands and long fingers and short thumbs, and they have huge upper body strength. And to take the two rocks and hit them together, you know, once they got the idea maybe this is going to pay off, was physically difficult for them without bashing their fingers. And the first round of this, Kenzie tried it a bit, wasn't hitting hard enough to remove a piece of rock, and got discouraged and wanted nothing more to do with it. With more demonstration and more encouragement, eventually he began to get the issue, but he realized that there was a better way to do this. And so in an outdoor enclosure, he had an enclosure where there was mulch and leaves and stuff on the ground. He'd find a rock, maybe one of the two rocks he'd been given to make stone tools out of, plant it, and throw the other rock at it. That worked much better as far as he was concerned. Mm-hmm. Didn't hurt his fingers immediately. If you throw hard enough and you have the upper body strength to do it, gave you nice sharp fragments. Well, they thought, okay, we can't have him do this. We'll take him inside because that's not the point. So they took him inside. He threw rocks on the tile floor until they broke. They carpeted the area. He ripped the carpet up. They took him outside again and put one of the rocks in a wading pool and fixed it in there. So if he threw the other rock at it, he not only got wet, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but the force was dissipated and it didn't fracture. Then he began to really learn how to do it manually. But the insight here is several things. One is, of course, you think you're controlling the experiment, and the bonobo is controlling the experiment. Another is, it made the very tangible point that just because we make stone tools this way, that doesn't mean it's the only way it can be done. Tansy found a bonobo way to make stone tools that worked much better for him as far as he was concerned. So although our ancestors at the time they invented making stone tools had anatomy very much like our own, they might not have, in another universe or another animal, and they might have invented different ways to do it. And the question is whether we would see that. Maybe we would, maybe we wouldn't. And it's a reminder that you can try to trace things into the past from the modern day, but the past was different. When you're doing this for the first time and nobody's teaching you how, nobody's showing you how, it's really hard. And it's hard anyway, I have to tell you. I can't make a good stone tool to save my life. I haven't been willing to spend enough time on it or endure the bashed fingers. And
it is more than just smacking two rocks together. There's a lot more to it.
When somebody knows how to do it, they're just hitting one rock against another. It's so easy, you wouldn't believe it. And then you try it, and it's so hard.
Yeah. Well, I do, again, recall sitting in, Anthropology 101 and at least seeing a movie of somebody doing it. And it does, in fact, look like, well, yeah, you're just smacking these two rocks together, and it looks like it should be pretty easy. But it's not something I have had personal experience with.
Yeah, it's quite an eye-opener. And, of course, you have to know about the properties of different kinds of rocks. Mm-hmm. Because some of them you can smack together all day, and you're not going to get a nice flake off it, because that's not the way the integral structure of the rock is. And there are other ones that you look at and say, oh, boy, that's a dynamite one to start with, because that's the right kind of rock. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more to that seemingly simple invention. And, of course, part of it is this huge change in ecology and your position in the community, the animal community that you live in. Coming back to the issue of being both a predator and a prey at once.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Pat Shipman. She's professor emerita of anthropology at Penn State and is author of the new book, The Animal Connection, A New Perspective on What Makes Us Human. It is published by W.W. Norton. And here's a caller over in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. You point out that stone tools made a huge step for us forward in our evolutionary process by not evolving. I'd like to point out that we used other tools prior to that to get to the stone tool. We used a lot of wood. We used a lot of bone. We used a lot of different things that we found because the best stone tools are not made by hitting two rocks against each other. The best stone tools are made by napping. And by using napping, what they did is they would break a piece off with a rock, but then you force the edge with a bone or an antler or something like that to make the sharp edge that is truly useful.
I agree with the caller that it's very likely we used other tools before we used stone. We don't have convincing evidence of that, however. We don't have universally recognized things, and some of it is a matter of survival and preservation. Now, the napping with the baton, it's called, with antler or bone, is a much more sophisticated method of shaping stone tools, and it certainly makes you not necessarily more useful, but more specifically useful stone tools. But for a very long time, stone tools were made by hitting one rock on another, and that is where the original tool making impetus came from. So our caller is quite right that the techniques used in the beginning gave way to much more sophisticated techniques that did involve the use of other substances, and probably other substances were used quite early on. We simply are lacking the evidence because of the nature of preservation and the record we have to work with. So we can't know what was done if there may have been, you know, wooden tools or reed tools or skin tools or many kinds of things. But if they don't survive, we can't talk about them very knowledgeably.
Thank you very much.
I want to return to the subject of a language for just a moment, because you also make the argument that once the stone tools make it possible for people to be much more effective hunters, supplying them with attributes that they don't come by naturally, and that then that we go from that to people spending more time hunting and doing it in an organized fashion. But then the next step is, well, if you're going to do that, you really have to be able to collect, share information about where the animals are and how you go get them. So that brings you to language. And the problem here is that, you know, we have no prehistoric dictionary, so we really don't know exactly what this was all about. But you do, again, make this really interesting argument. It says, well, look at art. Look at the art that we do have, the oldest art that we have. What do you see? You see animals and very little else, which should tell you something very important about what people were thinking about the animals and then, you know, what they chose to depict in the communication technologies that they had.
Yes, that was another revelation for me personally as I was working this all out. You can see that, you know, once you start becoming predator and prey, there is this tremendous value on information and knowledge of other animals and what they're doing and their habits and so on. And you can, of course, either each individually relearn that information or you can help demonstrate it to others in your group. But organizing that information and transmitting it, as you get more and more and more expertise, becomes a problem. You get to an information overload point, and that is where I think the value of language or communication comes in. Now, when I say language, I don't just mean spoken language, because not all languages are spoken. And clearly, other animals communicate to each other through scent, through posture, through behavior. I mean, it's quite clear that there is a communication system among many animals that they share with their conspecifics. So I began thinking about, okay, so how do you do this? How do you record this information and transmit it, and how do you hang on to the thing that your great-grandfather knew, but your great-grandfather has been dead since you were born? And the answer is some kind of sophisticated communication system. And there are general attributes of communication systems. They rely on symbols. That is, the meaning of the word television doesn't have anything to do with the noise a television makes. Or tree does not mean something that goes tree. Some of our words do, like meow is supposed to sound like what a cat says. But many of the words are completely arbitrary symbols, as are written signs or manually made signs in Amislan, for example. So they're symbolic. The second point is that both the speaker and the receiver, the spoken to, have to share the vocabulary. So it doesn't, I can draw all the little stars I want, but if you don't know what star means, it's of no value. And there has to be some topic that we're speaking about. There is a subject to all communications. If you look through the fossil and archaeological record, of course, there's this problem. We don't have a Paleolithic dictionary. We don't know what things sounded like. The words haven't fossilized, but we do have symbols. Some of the symbols are extremely ancient, and they are what's generally called geometric, meaning we can't recognize what they are, but they're made up of lines. But when you get to the prehistoric art that comes out of, say, fabulous caves like Lascaux in France, or Chauvet Cave, which is the subject of a film that's making the rounds now, we can look at them and we know instantaneously what the topic is. We know that's a lion. We know that's an elk. It doesn't take any special knowledge to recognize the animals. They are so realistically portrayed. And then I started looking at, okay, so what are all the subjects of these symbols? They're symbolic. What's there? What's represented? And it's overwhelmingly animals. There are very few people, and the people are not generally done realistically. There's no sort of handbook how to make a stone tool for dummies. There's nothing about making tools. There's nothing about where you find water, which you would think might be very, very important, or how you find a safe shelter, or how you know if there's a cave bear in the back of that cave, so you'd better not camp in the front of it. None of that is portrayed. It's not about social interactions. There are very few scenes of people doing things. There are not drawings of berries and trees and edible plants. Over and over and over again, the subject of that early art is animals. And that says to me that the need to communicate information about animals is hugely important. When you've seen pictures or been lucky enough to go to some of these places and see this original art, first of all, it's magnificently emotional. But also, if you start thinking about how long it took to make this stuff, you have to go, you have to know where to get the pigments. You have to gather them. You have to grind them up until they're powder. Then you have to find something to bind them with. Then you have to have something to mix them in, some kind of receptacle. Then you have to have some way of applying them to the wall or the object. If you've got, you know, say you're making little sculptures, you have to know where to get the clay or where to get the rock that you can make into the shape you want, and that will take the paint that you have created. All of this is hugely time-consuming, and it means you're not going out and catching dinner, and you're not looking after the babies. You know, pretty clearly, some people were devoting large spans of time to being artists and recording this information, and that means they were helped out by others in their group. They were probably fed by others. Maybe their children were cared for by others. This is expensive in terms of resources. And all of that says to me that language had a huge payoff because it made sense to put all those resources into supporting the person who made the art, who made the tangible language.
We have a caller here I want to include and again to quickly introduce reintroduce our guest, Pat Shipman. She is a professor emerita of anthropology at Penn State, and we're talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in her book, The Animal Connection. The subtitle is A New Perspective on What Makes Us Human, which looks at the significance of animals in the lives of human beings and the ways in which being connected to animals in a variety of ways really contributes to human evolution. Here's a caller to talk with. They're in Urbana, where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question. I am struck by the fact that these people from long ago painted animals and not people, that they didn't look at each other and paint each other or try to represent each other, let alone the natural environment. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that, and I will hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, there are no, you go into those caves, there are no portraits. So clearly, other than things that don't really rise above stick figures, the paintings of the animals are extremely beautiful. They're very sophisticated, wonderful use of shading and color. They're just stunningly beautiful. So you'd think, well, the reason they didn't paint each other, it wasn't lack of technical skill. They should have able to do that if they had wanted to, but clearly they didn't want to, or they didn't feel the need to.
Yeah, that in some sense that wasn't the point. I'm not sure why it wasn't the point. You know, that's a really interesting question. It could mean that people were living in such small groups and, knew the other people and everything they were doing so well that this was not a subject that merited permanent record. It could be that, alternatively, that portraying other people was in some sense risky, taboo, too personal, not public information necessarily. You know, we can sit and come up with all kinds of fascinating ideas about why people are so rarely portrayed. And I don't mean to say there are no people. There are. And, for example, many people will have heard of the Venus of Willendorf, the famous figurine of a generously proportioned lady. And there are many other Venuses. But we're talking about maybe, at a guess without counting, there may be 20. And there are thousands of animal depictions. So it's quite a different order of magnitude. And I don't know why people are not portrayed, but they're not. Or they are certainly a less common subject, much less common subject. So that suggests to me that recording and encoding and communicating this information about other animals was the original point behind language. Now, that's not what we necessarily do with language now. That was a long time ago. And much of modern language is about other people, is about gossip, is about social interactions and regulating communities and deciding what's acceptable behavior and what is not. But that doesn't seem to be what it was in the beginning. Hmm.
We're coming to the point we have maybe about 5-6 minutes. There's one thing I want to make sure that I give you a chance to talk a little bit about at least, and if people want to read more, they can look at the book. But this is the domestication of animals. And you make a really interesting observation, because I think people tend to associate domestication of animals with the development of agriculture and the whole business of people settling down and moving from being itinerant hunters to people who live in in villages and in a settled way. And they think of the domestication of animals as being related to the agriculture, and the idea as well, they were domesticated as a food source. You know, we domesticated these animals so we could eat them. And you make this interesting observation that says, well, if that really was what this was all about, the first thing people would have domesticated would have been, you know, a cow, a sheep, a goat. But it wasn't.
Yes, this is some fairly new work, and it has changed and deepened even since I published the book. It's moving that fast. The first animal to be domesticated was a dog. And if you ask people why they have pets now or why they have domestic animals, it's either, well, you know, it's herds of animals we're going to eat, or for the unconditional love that my pets bring to me. And, you know, I believe that utterly. I am terribly devoted to my pets. But think about where it starts. It starts with a wolf. And if you want to look at an animal from which you would not expect unconditional love, wolves have got to be right up on the list. Nobody in their right mind would take home a baby wolf thinking they were going to get unconditional love for it, and I don't think they did in the first generation. I think it took a very, very long time. Recent work by an international team headed by Mietje Germanpree in Belgium has shown that the first dogs were domesticated over 30,000 years ago. That is just about the time that the cave paintings start being made in Europe. And in the last few months, more evidence of dogs in terms of skeletal remains have come up from other parts of the world. Clearly, there are dogs at 30,000 years ago, and there are not villages and domesticated sheep and cattle and goats and all of that until at the earliest 12,000 years ago. So there's an 18,000-year gap in there, maybe more, maybe 20,000-year gap. Domestication is not about getting something to eat. Now, people can call in and say, oh, but people eat dogs. Of course they eat dogs. I mean, I don't think it's an of course, but, you know, I know it's done. I know it has been done. I know it can be done. But if you want to grow an animal to eat, grow a sheep. It pays off. The whole process takes much less time. They grow up faster. They produce meat faster. They don't eat you in the process. And sheep or goats or cattle don't require 5 pounds of meat a day, which a wolf requires to keep in breeding shape. So if you wanted meat, why would you start with something that took 5 pounds of meat a day? It makes no sense at all. What the wolf was, turning into dog, was a hunting aid and a guardian and a member of your family group that had better senses in some ways than you do, that was able to do parts of the hunt or defend the group or warn the group, that they would pick up warning signs that the humans would not. So it's an enabler. It's another kind of tool. It's a living tool whose value is in being alive and what it can bring you while it's alive and part of your group, not the dinner you might get out of it once it's dead. Mm. That's a big revelation to me, too.
And
agriculture is not about meat only.
And do you, and again, we're real short on time. So, this is such a fascinating story. We're really short on time. But I wonder whether you think that the kind of, that the features of this relationship now, the fact that people, we keep animals for companionship, that at what point might you think that would come into the equation? And so this utilitarian kind of attitude people took to the animals, that it indeed was another kind of a tool, that that something else started to become operative there too.
Oh, I think it was from the very beginning. Hmm. If you start with the dog as a fellow hunter and fellow family member whose value is in being alive, not in being dead, I think it's all the way through, and I think that's why animals have such a hold on our hearts. There was an article in my local newspaper today about grieving over the loss of a pet and how some people regard this as trivial, but it's valid and real, and it's a terrible loss to people. And that's true. It is like losing a family member. It is a family member for many people. And I think that is because our connection to animals is so ancient and so deep that when we open up that communication with them, which we generally do with our pets and many good farmers do with their livestock, there is a real communication there. There is a real connection. And it's not like having a dolly or a cute little robot that does something or other. It's a living being, and it communicates back to you, and it loves you back.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop. We're just at the end. There's more, indeed, people can read. It's quite a fascinating story. So I would direct them to the book that we've been talking about, The Animal Connection, A New Perspective on What Makes Us Human. It is published by W.W. Norton and by our guest, Pat Shipman. She is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at Penn State University. And Professor Shipman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for talking with me. This has been an interesting hour, and I thank the callers who called in and all the ones who didn't get up their nerve to call in, because there are a lot of ins and outs to this story.
All right, very good. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show that we first presented in August, on August 17th. If you visit the archives at WILL.illinois.edu, you will find many programs available for you anytime that you're ready to listen. And also that way you can check the schedule for the days and weeks ahead so you'll know what we'll be doing. Maybe there'll be something there that sounds interesting to you and you'll want to make certain that you hear the program. So again, that's at our website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. We have concluded our tower work, and we're back on the air. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. And good morning to you. This is Focus, our morning talk program, the show coming to you today from the archives, both hours, and they are both programs that first were broadcast in August. In the second hour of the show, this is a conversation that Celeste Quinn had with Dr. Mark Agronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist, and she talked with him back in August about a book that he'd written. The title of the book is How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. So that means that once again, in the second hour of the show today, we will not be taking calls. We will be here live as usual on Monday. In the first part of the program on Monday, we'll be talking about information technology and how that now makes it possible for doctors, any doctor anywhere, to get complete access to a person's full medical history. And that's something that can be very important. It can give that doctor a life-saving advantage. But it also opens the way for massive violations of privacy. So on the program Monday at 10, we'll be talking about a major research effort that is aimed at improving the security of electronic medical records. And the guest for the program will be Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science here at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Then in the second hour, this was a program that we were going to do a couple of weeks ago, and at the last moment, we weren't able to hook up with the guest, but we'll be doing it on Monday. And it's all about Jonestown. And certainly you'll remember that 1,000 people died in Jonestown in the fall of 1978. They had followed the Reverend Jim Jones because they believed he could lead them to a better life, and the result was this mass suicide, something that really had been planned a long time advance of that event. So on the program on Monday at 11 o'clock, Julia Shears will be talking about her new book. It's titled 1,000 Lives. It profiles 5 members of the People's Temple, she says, in an effort to restore the victims their humanity as individuals. So that's Monday. Again, we're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we'll take our usual break so we can bring you news from NPR and an update on the commodity markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where wheat futures are up for a fifth straight day in a row. That's the entire week now, as short sellers are exiting the market on increased hopes for a solution to the Eurozone debt crisis and some minor signs that the the U.S. economy is beginning to heal itself. Corn is holding firm, though, also, and choppy dealings in that pit. And soybeans are rising in line with the broad-based commodities rally that we're seeing all across the floor today, as well as on some mounting concerns about some pockets of dry weather in South America. Of course, that's the world's largest soybean-producing region. Corn, as we're looking at how it's looking on the end of the week charts, higher for the week, and that might be for the first time in 3 weeks. And, of course, soybeans are on their biggest